A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll get a closer look at the years George Frideric Handel spent in London and the development of his composition output from Italian opera to oratorios. My guest will be conductor Jane Glover, whose book Handel in London, The Making of a Genius, was published late last year. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. The music world lost another giant this past week with the death of conductor, jazz pianist, and composer André Previn. The New York Times reported that Previn died Thursday, February 28th at the age of 89, citing his manager. Born in Berlin, he escaped Nazi Germany in 1938 when his family first moved to Paris, where he studied at the Paris Conservatory, and then Los Angeles, where his teachers included Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco. According to the Times, Previn got his start writing for the movies even before he graduated from high school, helping with the score for Holiday in Mexico. His film works went on to include scores for Gigi, Porgy and Bess, and Irma La Douce, for which he won Oscars. He also was a noted conductor, serving as principal conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra for 11 years and music director of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra and Los Angeles Philharmonic, among other positions. His classical compositions included the opera A Brief Encounter, and he also recorded jazz and crossover albums. This year's Oscar for Best Original Score went to first-time nominee Ludwig Göransson, whose music for the blockbuster hit Black Panther also garnered a Grammy Award. Among the Swedish composer's earlier soundtracks include music for Creed, Everything Everything, and Fruitvale Station. Other Academy Award contenders for Best Score this year were two-time Oscar winner Alexander Desplat for Isle of Dogs, Terrence Blanchard, a longtime film score composer for Spike Lee for Black Klansman, Mark Scheiman for Mary Poppins Returns, and Nicholas Britell for If Beale Street Could Talk. Lady Gaga, Mark Ronson, Anthony Rossomando, and Andrew Wyatt won the Academy Award for Best Original Song for Shallow from A Star Is Born. If you were watching the award ceremony, you could have also seen superstar conductor Gustavo Dudamel leading the Los Angeles Philharmonic during the In Memoriam tribute. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world.
We walk together up the river.
Many composers whose lives and work reflected current events and the political world around them, influenced either by their own perspectives or patronage. But perhaps few would have lives that were so tightly and directly intertwined with historical happenings than George Frideric Handel, whose personal and professional ties to the German family that would ascend to the British crown would put him in a position to become one of England's great composers. While not British-born, he settled in London at the age of 27, became a British subject, and would live there for nearly another half century. That period in London saw an extraordinary output of operas, oratorios, and orchestral works, and is the subject of a recently published book by conductor and scholar Jane Glover called Handel in London, The Making of a Genius. Currently music director of Music of the Baroque, Glover has also served as music director of the Glyndebourne Touring Opera and artistic director of the London Mozart Players. She's also the author of the book Mozart's Women. I spoke with Glover recently about the book and what has attracted her to Handel and his vast output of musical works.
Handel has been part of my life, actually, forever. You know, as I say in the book, I heard my first performance of Messiah when I was 9 years old, and although I'm sure I couldn't articulate it at that point, there was something instinctive in me that registered that I was going to be a musician. I mean, it really was a sort of life-changing moment. And since then, you know, as I've grown up and played and sung and become a conductor and all that, You know, Handel has been an enormous feature of all my activity, not just indeed Messiah, of which I've conducted more than 100 performances, but, you know, I've done a lot of the operas and oratorios, and he's just a composer who means a tremendous amount to me. And I wrote a book about Mozart about 12 years or so ago, and after that, it was suggested that I did another one, which I thought, well, I'm not sure about that. But then somebody said, you know, you should do a book about Handel, and here it is. rather late in the day. It took me a long time, but here it is. And I still can't believe I finished it, really.
Well, certainly one of the challenges was, as you point out, is just the lack of letters and his own personal accounts that we have to work with. What challenges did that pose, and what were you able to turn to get a sense of Handel, the person, and the composer?
Yeah, you're so right. I mean, having written a book about Mozart, where, of course, we have literally hundreds of letters from him, where, you know, he tells us exactly what he's feeling at all hours of day and night. There's such a treasure trove, and into him, quite apart from the music, as an insight into him. So to have just 14 sort of pretty much business letters from Handel is nothing. There is nothing that's going to tell us anything about what he's doing. Having said that, you know, he was a much documented man, celebrity, particularly in London. I mean, he was such a sort of superstar that his every move was documented. You know, if he went to Tunbridge Wells to take the waters, or if he left the country to go looking for singers, all that was documented. And people wrote about him, not always politely. You know, he had very good friends, and he had a few enemies. And so one learns about him from that sort of thing. But as always, one finds, although he wasn't an autobiographical composer at all, I do find that there are massive insights into him in certain of his pieces, you know, particularly his dramatic works, the way he conveys emotion and situation through drama, that tells us subliminally a lot about him. And he was hard to get to know, but I think, my goodness, after all these years of cohabiting with him, I think I have got to know him. I hope I've done him justice.
You do capture his energy and his very hardworking qualities. How would you characterize him? What do we know about Handel, the person, and the musician behind the composer?
Well, he was a ferocious workaholic, as I'm sure you've gathered. I mean, he was just always full of ideas and full of activity, and not just writing his operas and his oratorios and his concertos and his keyboard music and all that stuff, writing a massive corpus of music that we still enjoy centuries later. But he also getting the situations together where this stuff was going to be performed. He was much involved in management and entrepreneurship and the getting of money, and he had a formidable business sense. I mean, he was, unlike my poor Mozart, who was absolutely hopeless with money. I mean, Handel was brilliant with money. He had a really, really good head for it. He was much assisted by the fact that he personally never had any money worries. But I would say also that he was very good at handling it, pardon the pun. You know, he played the stock market very successfully. He bought shares all the time and sold them at the right time. Spectacularly, he bought shares in the South Sea Company, which, of course, famously burst its bubble in the early 1720s. But Handel had sold his shares before the bubble burst. I mean, he had that sort of a nose for business. And he applied that business sense to running opera companies and assembling Lenten series of concerts for his oratorios. And then, of course, his great charitable works. I mean, particularly in his later life, he had a fantastically compassionate side to him, and, you know, set up charities for people in difficulties. I mean, the society was then called the Society for Decayed Musicians. terrible title. It's now called the Musicians Benevolent Fund. I mean, it's been through many different names, but it continues to this day, and that was partly set up by him. And of course, his whole association with the Foundling Hospital, one of the most heartbreaking charities in London, which he was very much involved with, and gave hugely productive concerts for. You know, they would make a great deal of money for them, and then of course he left them his material for Messiah, that little thing, which has really brought it great stability and security over the centuries. So we see all that. I know I haven't answered your question as to what he was like, apart from being hardworking and compassionate. He was essentially a loner, having said all that. I mean, he was a very gregarious person in that he loved going to other people's houses. He was very comfortable in any company, whether he was with the royal family. He was a close friend of Queen Caroline and George II, particularly the Queen, I think, who, you know, they were fellow Germans. They were the same age. They'd virtually come over from Germany to England at the same time. So there was a very close relationship there, and he was very comfortable in their company. Also with, you know, various friends throughout London, people who were supporters of his, he loved to go and visit with them. And, you know, he would have a few beers with the lay clerks at St. Paul's Cathedral after business was over at the end of the day. He loved all that. But I think the other side to all that is that he liked to go back to his home in Brook Street and shut the door. And get on with the business, the alternative business of writing music, which is, I think, where he, as with many composers, was in a curious way truly happy. He was never really lonely, but I think he never married, as we all know. People speculate as to whether or not he was gay. There's absolutely no evidence for that, absolutely none. He had a relationship with a soprano in Italy in his youth, which is much documented and was the gossip of halls all over Europe, actually. But, you know, a permanent relationship never came his way. And I think he valued and loved his own solitude, actually. And there was nothing sinister or anything in that. It was just the way he was.
Well, you mentioned his relationship to the royal family, and I don't think I've ever read a composer's biography that really was so wrapped up in major world historic events. And I'm wondering, how did that close relationship impact Handel and the trajectory of his career?
Well, it was crucial in a sense. I mean, you know, the timing of his arrival in London. The first thing he did, he arrived at the end of 1710 and did Rinaldo spectacularly in 1711. But that was on, you know, it was just a sort of, let's see how we get on in London sort of thing. And then he went back to Hanover, where they in fact had offered him a job, and where the young elector, who was destined to be the English king for those complicated reasons, which we all know a bit more about since everybody's seen the film called The Favourite and knows a lot more about Queen Anne. But I have to say, when I wrote my stuff about Queen Anne, which was a long time ago, there was none of this excitement about her that we're enjoying now. But the Hanoverians came over when Anne died without issue, and the people he'd known in Hanover in his youth, therefore, were on the throne. And, of course, this meant that regardless of other British composers, truly British composers, who had important jobs at the Chapel Royal or St. Paul's Cathedral or Westminster Abbey and were in charge of sort of music in the theatres, it meant that Handel, of course, was close to this royal family and was often preferred to the locals for important occasions, like, for instance, the coronation of George II when he wrote those four amazing anthems, or before that for, you know, George I's party on the Thames, for which he wrote the water music. And any sort of political event, you know, the peace of this or the royal wedding of that, and all that, he would be the person who was immediately thought of. Having said that, if he had not had that very nice royal approbation, I think he would have still had the career that he did. in London through the theatrical world. Then whether that would have developed, it's an interesting question, whether that would have developed into the oratorio world that he effectively invented without his attachment to the ecclesiastical communities, and would he have had that without the royal family? And that's a very interesting speculation. So the answer to your question is that it was important to him, hugely important to his career, but also to his person. I think they were really good friends, George II and his wife.
Well, looking at his musical output, as you mentioned, so much of his career, particularly not just the early career, but a good portion of it was devoted to Italian opera. But if you ask certainly just the casual classical music lover or even people with a little more knowledge, that's not necessarily the things that come to mind when you ask them, what do we know Handel for? Why is it that those Italian operas just kind of faded in comparison to the oratorios and some of his other orchestral works?
Well, I would take issue with that, to be honest. Certainly, in the course of my own career, I've seen a massive sea change with regard to the popularity of Handel's operas. When I started out a few decades ago, you know, it was quite rare to find a Handel opera being performed, you know, sort of one a year maybe somewhere. But now you go to any opera house and they've all got Handel in their repertory somewhere. It's wonderful. And, you know, there's been a great revival of interest in his operas, I think, partly through the original instrument, historically informed movement, which has very much grown up and over the last sort of 20, 30 years, but also through the inexorable rise of the countertenor, which has meant that we can now perform these great male roles by have them performed by men, but who are not haven't been castrated as the original singers were. So there is a huge amount of revival of that. But, I mean, yes, you ask the casual person in the street, but, you know, what do you know? You know the water music and you know Messiah and all that. The oratorios, obviously, being in the vernacular, they're all written in English as opposed to in Italian, were immediately more popular for audiences. I mean, it always amazes me, really, that in the 18th century, Handel went on writing operas for 30 years in London, when essentially there were foreign stories sung by foreign people in a foreign language. And you'd think that that craze might last for 4 or 5 years, but not for 30 years. So again, that's a tribute to the quality of what he was producing and indeed the quality of the people that he was working with. But eventually, he moved across, as it were, to telling his dramatic stories from biblical texts and from for the Lenten season. And these, he just found this niche for these few weeks in the year when he could excite musical audiences with his stories like Saul and Solomon and Jephthah and Susanna and Samson and Israel in Egypt and Judas Maccabeus. And then the unlikely one of Messiah, which I think even he would have been astonished to know what Messiah had become for the whole of the world ever since.
Well, walk us through a little bit that trajectory of his career and how he, you know, went from the operas, and even though they continued throughout a good part of his career, how he adapted and moved and went through the oratorio and just really kept finding new directions and new ways to take his art.
The bottom line is he's still telling stories when he goes into oratorio from opera. It's just that the stories are told in English and they are with a religious, you know, taken from the Old Testament, only a couple from the New Testament. And he really has the same skills. He's just, obviously, the differences between an oratorio and an opera are that an oratorio is in English and an opera is in Italian, and an oratorio has choruses, which as a very important feature because the ecclesiastical choirs from Westminster Abbey and St Paul's would join to sing these oratorios for him in Lent. And, you know, the choruses, therefore, are very challenging and demanding because those singers were very good. And that was something that developed out of his sort of immersion also in British church music of the time. And, you know, he just was incredibly adaptable to new things. There was nothing really he couldn't do. Somebody asked me at a literary festival quite recently, you know, what was he bad at? And I couldn't think of anything, actually. He was actually extremely good at everything he turned his hand to. And that included, as I said earlier, you know, running a company, not just writing the notes and getting them performed and performing them. I mean, he was a dazzlingly proficient harpsichordist and performer himself. I mean, he was good at everything.
Well, you referred to kind of the earlier sort of lukewarm reception for Messiah, and yet it has become such a treasure. What is it about Messiah that really has given it its staying power and its majesty?
Well, the thing about Messiah is that it's an atypical oratorio because it's one with a third-person narrative rather than a first-person narrative. We're not having sort of dramatic stories told by the characters themselves, but, you know, we're having a sort of narrated, you know, there were shepherds abiding in the fields, keeping watch over their flocks by night, descriptive narrative. And it tells the whole story of the life of Christ with the Christmas story in part one, the Passion story in part two, and then this amazing part three, which is about redemption. It sort of covers everything we need, really. Most of us perform Messiah at Christmas because of part one, and it's become a sort of glorious tradition all over the world for that. He himself performed it at Easter because of part two, which is basically the central story. And I'm sure this is the way he saw it himself, as telling the Passion story, but preceding with the story so far, namely the Nativity and how that all happened, and followed by a sort of commentary about what Christ's death and resurrection have meant to us, namely redemption. And in that sense, it sort of satisfies. You can perform it at any time of the year, basically. And, you know, I love to do it Easter in the way that he did. But, you know, I've done Messiah in July and February, and, as well as mainly December and April. And just the quality of it is astonishing. As you know, I've done, as I say, over 100 performances, and I never get tired of it. Every number is a showstopper, whether it's, you know, the mighty Amen chorus with that brilliant counterpoint to finish with, or whether it's the heartbreaking arias like He Was Despised, or the uplifting arias like I Know That My Redeemer Liveth, or The Trumpet Shall Sound, or, you know, the way he tells the story of the shepherds being surprised and then frightened by the arrival of the angels and the announcement that there's a child being born, or whether we're being having our hearts broken by the way Christ is taunted on the cross in part two. You know, it's sort of got everything. It's got drama, it's got reflection, it's got serenity, it makes you think a lot, and you come out feeling better. And of course, I haven't even mentioned the word hallelujah, but there it is, the most famous chorus of all time. So not a bad piece, really.
How would you describe his influences and his impact on the music world in England, and to what extent what followed did or did not carry on some of his works?
Well, I think the invention, in inverted commas, of the oratorio is probably his most massive contribution to the history of music, actually, because, you know, without his oratorios, we would never have had The Creation or Elijah, and therefore the whole of the sort of 19th century choral oratorio tradition. We never had the Dream of Gorontius. You know, we would never have had any of this stuff. But because then big choirs grew up to sing these pieces. I mean, they were originally done with choirs from ecclesiastical institutions, but they quickly were taken over by amateur choral societies, which grew up to sing these things. And, you know, but even a few years after Handel's death, when they commemorated the centenary of his birth in Westminster Abbey in the 1780s, they had 500 people performing. Now, those sort of things had never been done. You know, that would have been unheard of in Handel's own day. I think he would have loved to know that that his music was being performed by so many people. But that was something that therefore spawned a whole, you know, all over the world, first all over the country and then all over the world, these choral societies grew up to sing these great works. And, okay, some of his oratorios faded into obscurity for maybe a century even or two, but they're all being sung now. And meanwhile, the great choral tradition, which was taken up in the 19th and 20th and 21st centuries, had been started by him. So that's his biggest contribution, I would say, but not by any means the only one.
As you were working on this, is there anything that you came across that surprised you about Handel or something you hadn't expected?
What surprised me constantly was because I looked at it as I tell it now in the book, very methodically, sort of season by season, and you see that just the pace at which he worked, and therefore all his performers worked, was absolutely mind-blowing. You look at some of the schedules for his Lenten festivals, and you know they're performing 3 or 4 oratorios in the period of 2 or 3 weeks, and that means rehearsing them and being all the music being in the right place and all the musicians being in the right place, and so that you're probably learning one, rehearsing another, and performing another, like the repertory company of theatre companies. And it was the same with the opera singers, actually, that everybody complained that they were very highly paid. Well, I think they earned every penny of their salaries because they were learning and performing this stuff constantly. And of course, it was all brand new. It was all contemporary music. They just had to buckle down and learn this music at immense speed. So the speed at which he produced it and the speed at which he then got it out to be rehearsed and performed and the speed at which he then performed it, all that is breathtaking, even for, you know, those of us perhaps especially for those of us who operate in this world in this day and age.
That was my conversation with conductor and musicologist Jane Glover, whose new book, Handel in London, The Making of a Genius, is published by Pegasus Books. You can find her website at jane-glover.com, and that's spelled G-L-O-V-E-R. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you on A Tempo each week, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. Remember, though, that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.